Hello, and welcome to Citizen 411, your information directory for democracy, where we want everyone represented and empowered in our democratic republic. Citizen 411 is powered by the League of Women Voters. We're nonpartisan, and we never promote candidates, but we do help people understand the issues so they can vote responsibly. I'm Tracy Riley Kelly.
And I'm Teresa Torres.
And I'm Rachel Bancroft.
So this month, our monthly civic happenings, Bravery Angels is holding a nonpartisan immigration workshop. It'll be held at the Camas Public Library on April 18th, 2026, to foster respectful dialogue between residents of varying political affiliations. Also, please remember this is a great time of year to sign up for commissions and boards or to see if you can get appointed to one. This is a wonderful way to be involved civically.
Dr. Alan Melnick is our guest today. Alan is the director of the Clark County Public Health and also the chief health officer. To describe his background would be an awfully long read. He's done so many credentialed and distinguished things. Dr. Melnick's BA is from New York University, his MD from Tufts University, and he also has a master's in public health from the University of Washington. He works with the Clark County Board of Health on public health policy. And working with the department's leadership team, he is responsible for ensuring the delivery of effective services and programs. Dr. Melnick, welcome.
Well, thank you. Thank you for allowing me to be here.
Our first question on this show is always, what do you do? And so the question is, what does the chief health officer do?
Great question. So in statute, in Washington law, it's specified and it's called the local health officer. And the local health officer has several responsibilities, but one is to enforce the public health laws of the state and the rules of the State Board of Health, as well as all local health rules, including ordinances. Also, I'm just giving you a couple of things that the health officer does, but control and prevent the spread of any dangerous, contagious, or infectious disease that may occur in Clark County, in the jurisdiction where you work. Keep the public informed. Prevent and control and abate nuisances, for example. So a variety of I didn't list them all, but I list a number of them.
Well, we're sure going to talk and ask you.
Oh, the other thing I would add is that we also oversee inspection of water systems, public water systems, and take whatever action is necessary to promote public health in Clark County.
Well, thank you. We need that. So I believe that measles was once declared eliminated in the United States, but now we're seeing cases reappear, including a recent exposure at Ridgefield High School, with county vaccination rates way below the level needed for herd immunity. So what's causing this resurgence, and what do Clark County residents need to understand right now about protecting themselves and their children?
A great question. So measles was once considered eradicated in the United States, and over the last couple of years, especially in the last year, we've seen a huge resurgence. You might recall that Clark County had a measles outbreak in 2019, and after that, immunization rates began to go up, but they've been declining recently. And one of the concerns we have is that, you know, parents want to do the best things for their children, but with the amount of misinformation that's going on, including misinformation that's coming from the CDC at this point and the federal government, people get confused. They want to do what's right for their children, but they have questions about the safety or the effectiveness of the vaccine. So they're choosing, the vaccination rates are getting lower. Fortunately, in Ridgefield, at the high school there, the immunization rates were still high. In fact, they were between 95 and 96%, which is what you need for herd immunity. Right. And we didn't have, other than that case that was at Ridgefield, we didn't have any other cases spread in the high school. Nope. You know, those public exposures didn't cause any cases. But if this case were to occur at another school in Clark County where the immunization rates are much lower, we would have likely seen more cases.
So how have recent changes at the CDC represent a departure from the longstanding evidence-based frameworks that have guided disease prevention and a response for decades? So from your perspective, what has shifted And what does that mean for public health practice here in Clark County?
What has shifted is, as you know, the ACIP that oversees immunizations recommendations has been gutted and changed. And now the recommendations coming out of ACIP and the CDC are not evidence or science-based. And they eliminated a number of recommendations for a number of vaccines that are particularly concerning. And along with that, you know, the message that they're putting out is increasing confusion among the public about the safety and efficacy of vaccines. They're incredibly safe, and it's the best way you can protect yourselves and your children, especially the real vulnerable people around us. But the message that's coming out from the CDC and the ACIP is really disconcerting. It's not science-based. It's not evidence-based.
Dr. Melnick, with changing national messaging and growing confusion, where should Clark County residents go for reliable and up-to-date vaccine guidance? And further, if someone is hesitant or unsure, what is the most responsible step?
The best thing that people can do is talk to their physician. If they're, you know, if it's their child, talk to their child's physician, their pediatrician or family doc to get the right information. They can also contact their health department. We are relying now, instead of relying on the CDC, we're relying on the recommendations and the schedule made by the American Academy of Pediatrics. So you can go to the American Academy of Pediatrics website and see their recommendations. We're also aligning with the American Academy of Family Practice and the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. So there are reliable places to go, but unfortunately not the CDC right now.
Right. And when you're looking at Clark County specifically, where are we seeing the biggest gaps in health outcomes or access to care? And what's the public health doing locally to address those gaps?
Well, that's a real big question. We're talking about healthcare in general, not just immunizations.
Right.
So one of the concerns we have, and we brought this to the Board of Health, is access to prenatal care, especially for the Apple Health, the Medicaid population. So we're seeing issues around that, inadequate networks. People can't get in to see their doctor or a doctor for prenatal care, so they can't get in. We're also, and we've been concerned about this for a long time, that there's equity issues. So people, you know, people of color, BIPOC populations have less access to a variety of services, including prenatal care.
So from the advisory council's perspective, how does the Clark County ensure that essential public health services like immunizations, maternal health, or communicable disease responses are accessible to residents who may not have a regular health care provider?
Well, we don't deliver direct services ourselves, so we work with our community partners on that. But we do have the ability, you know, the Board of Health passed a resolution around prenatal care and concerns about that, actually convened a summit about that. So we work with our partners, and actually we work with the legislature to ensure that these services are available. But we have work to do.
So do you go out into the community and like have brochures? I mean, how do you tell people, here's where you can go and get help, or here's where you can go get, I mean, is that part of your...
We provide education to the public, and we can suggest where people can go, and you can go to our website and see that. But we don't – the healthcare, including Medicaid, is a, is through the healthcare authority.
Okay.
So we, you know, we advocate and we work with the Department of Health, advocate for improved access, but it's still challenging.
Because of all of these challenges, are you thinking that there's going to be poorer health in our community in the next year?
Well – that poorer health is due to a variety of things. Healthcare access is one aspect. The other, you know, there's something we call the social determinants of health as well. So poor health outcomes are due not only to inadequate healthcare access, but to inadequate housing, lack of access to healthy food, education, challenges around education, including early childhood education and making that available, and early childhood trauma. So there are a variety of things that contribute to poor health outcomes that we work on. We work, public health works more on the upstream, so we try to address prevention, whereas we rely on our healthcare partners to provide adequate and the financing system to provide access to care for people.
Well, public health also monitors food safety and even things like outbreak investigations of maybe norovirus, I guess. You could tell us what that is. When a foodborne illness surfaces, what does happen behind the scenes?
Yeah, great question. So with foodborne, so a lot of the conditions that cause foodborne illness are notifiable conditions. For example, E. coli, Shigatoxin E. coli. Those are reported. So when somebody is diagnosed with that, it's reported to us, and we investigate that. If there's an outbreak, if there's a number of cases in norovirus, we will investigate that at all as well. It's we do case investigation and contact tracing. So when we have a reported illness, we ask people about their exposures. So where with the E. coli, it will be any kind of exposure they had in up to seven to ten days before they develop symptoms. If we identify a number of people who had the same exposure, we can identify a potential source. For example, if it's a restaurant, then we investigate further, and we'll do an inspection of the restaurant, for example, identify whether there have been any ill food handlers, whether they're risky practices. But there's a lot of other sources about some of these conditions besides restaurants. Petting zoos, for example, you can get water exposures, person-to-person spread. So it is a lot of work to investigate cases and identify potential causes. But we look to see commonalities in cases and particular exposures, if that makes sense.
It does. You have the food safety. You're the ones that the chart that I look at the Columbian.
You do inspections also, right? So there's a whole.
So we have our communicable disease team who does the, interviews people who are cases and ask them about exposures. And if they identify something, we have our environmental public health food safety team that will actually go out and do an inspection. And one of the things it doesn't happen that often because it's difficult. If we identify a particular bacteria causing the disease in a person, and we actually try to get samples, if we identify a particular food that people had in common, we try to get samples from that as well and see if they match. We do some genetic testing. And it's not just restaurants. It could be food in commerce, like it's happened in the past, bagged lettuce, for example.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Sometimes what we find out at the local level will lead to recalls, including, we want to make sure that the food is not still available in commerce for more people to buy. So when we do an investigation, if we find a particular food item, whether it's in a restaurant or in a home, we'll do a trace back to see what the source was and look to see if there are other cases, even in other jurisdictions and other states. As you may have heard in the news, there are some, nationwide outbreaks related to particular foods. Well, that's first discovered usually or often at the local level.
Yeah. I'm always wary of romaine lettuce. Anyway.
Yeah, I'll wash it myself. You sort of wonder about this.
Right.
We need to take a quick break. We've been speaking today with Clark County Health Officer Dr. Alan Melnick, talking about the health department and about our community health. You are listening to Citizen 411, your information directory for democracy.
Welcome back to Citizen 411. We are your hosts, Tracy Riley Kelly, Rachel Bancroft, and Teresa Torres. Today we've been talking with Clark County Health Officer Dr. Alan Melnick. Dr. Melnick, as we've discussed, public health often works behind the scenes, preventing disease, monitoring outbreaks, even improving air and water quality. How is that different from individual medical care, and why does that unseen infrastructure matter to every resident of Clark County?
Thank you for that question. So I'm going to tell a little story here. Imagine you're standing on the side of a river and there are bodies floating down the river drowning, hundreds if not thousands of them. And you got some really wonderful people on the banks of the river who are diving in and pulling one of them out at a time. And they're obviously not able to get to the thousands that they're pulling people out at a time, and they're helping them. That's kind of what medical care does. Public health folks will hike upstream, and they will get upstream to the point where they find a cliff, and they look at the top of the cliff, and there's people who are falling off the edge of the cliff because there's not adequate protection or fencing on that cliff. And that's kind of going up upstream. The role of public health is ensure that people are safe at the top of that cliff so they don't fall into the river in the first place, and we're able to save many more of them. Imagine there's a couple of points on that cliff where there are some wealthier people who have better fencing, and there might be some low-income people and some black people who don't have, you know, there are not adequate fencing for. More of them are falling into the cliff as well.
Sure.
So public health tries to go upstream, literally, and make sure there's protections in place, like immunizations, for example, to keep people from ending up falling in the river and drowning.
Right. Very effective metaphor. So dental care can be difficult to access for lower-income families. What public health resources or partnerships exist locally to help bridge that gap?
Great question. So we have the ABCD program that you can go online and see it at our health department, but it's preventive dental care, including things like dental sealants for kids. And people should know that early dental care is essential in kids. And by the way, fluoridated water is helpful as well. And I believe the city of Vancouver's water is fluoridated, and they voted to continue that. Early childhood caries is named for cavities. Early childhood caries is the most common chronic disease in childhood. And when we're talking about social determinants of health, if a child has severe, you know, dental caries, that makes it very difficult for them to learn in school. And think about that disadvantage that they're at if they're not learning as well because of something that's completely, you know, very much preventable.
So shifting in another direction, if residents are concerned about the direction of public health policy locally or nationally, what are constructive ways they can engage at the county level?
Great question. So one of the things we look at in our community health assessment and community health improvement plan is community connection and how engaged people are. And a sign of health in a community is how engaged people are. So people can, one of the things they can do is they can go to Board of Health meetings. They could submit comments at Board of Health meetings. Mm-hmm. They can get. They can also go to Public Health Advisory Council meetings and make public comments and get involved as well. And they can also get involved in organizations that do this kind of work.
Mm-hmm.
For example, like, you know, the NAACP, for example, or other community organizations that are working to basically. One of the things they do is address the social determinants of health, mm-hmm. and help keep people healthy. But, you know, there's a number of organizations people can get involved in. They can get involved in their schools, for example. They can get at the school board and advocate for, you know, higher immunization rates in the schools. But getting involved in the community and community-based organizations is something that people can do, as well as engaging with the Board of Health as well.
Thank you. So looking ahead and also kind of thinking back the last few years, how public health has become a big topic ever since COVID. So looking ahead, what trends in public health are you watching most closely, and where do you see the strongest local capacity to respond?
That's a really good question. So I'm concerned, as we mentioned earlier, about what's happening at the federal level.
Right.
So I have concerns about capacity there. But we're actually replacing that to a certain degree. I mentioned that we're aligned with the medical organizations like the American Academy of Pediatrics, for example. We're aligned with the State Department of Health as well. And we're also aligned with, you may have heard of the West Coast Health Alliance.
Yeah.
So we're working closely with California, Oregon, Hawaii to replace some of the resources that formerly existed. So we're doing that work as well. Locally, or even statewide, is one thing that people can engage in is make sure there's adequate funding for public health. We lost some, the state provides funding called Foundational Public Health Services funding, and we lost some of that funding this year, but hopefully people can advocate, you know, talk to their legislators so mm-hmm. that in 2027 we can restore some of that funding.
So this network, the Oregon, Washington, California network, is that the network we should look at? Like if there's some kind of new virus that starts spreading across the world, where do we go to get the best information?
You can still get the best information from those organizations okay. and the West Coast Health yeah. Alliance. The concern I have about diseases spreading across the globe is what's happening with, you know, lack of involvement in the World Health Organization yeah. and, you know, working with partners across the world because right. these bugs don't really care about political boundaries.
Right.
So concerns about that as well.
Well, you know, while we're talking about emerging public health risks that we don't know and something coming in another part of the world, I'd really like to ask you is how does it feel to you, though, with the huge public risk by misinformation coming out of this MAHA organization? Tell us a couple of things that you find particularly damaging that they are misinformation to the public.
Well, I'll give you one example. The removal of the recommendation for hepatitis B immunization at childbirth. I believe, if I have my numbers correctly, that before the hepatitis B vaccine at childbirth, we had 38,000 kids infected with hepatitis B at birth. And now that recommendation has been taken away by the CDC. And there's a couple of concerns about that. One is we don't have adequate prenatal care. So many women are not being screened in the first place for hepatitis B. And they can pass it on, you know, at birth to their child. And many people with hepatitis B don't have symptoms. They're just carrying it in their bloodstream. If a young child gets infected, they have a much higher rate of getting liver failure and liver mm-hmm. cancer from hepatitis B, much, much higher than adults who get hepatitis B. And there's also misinformation that it's only passed through the mother. So hepatitis B is spread through blood contact, but it's very contagious, and it lasts in the environment. So children, even if their mother was not infected with hepatitis B, young children can pick it up. If there's somebody in the household who has it, the infection, but doesn't have symptoms, doesn't know they have it, through even things like sharing a toothbrush or a brush or something, you can get enough of transmission. And that's how many kids get infected. So this critical Hep B vaccination at childbirth is essential to protect these children. And many children are, you know, going to die if they don't get, if there are people who don't get the vaccination. So that's just an example. And I figured it was an example to illustrate this.
Disturbing one. Yes.
It also raises concerns about other vaccines. You know, if you cut the recommendation for this one, what mm-hmm. are people going to think in general? And it causes confusion among the public.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Melnick, Citizen 411 was fortunate to see you speak at a local NAACP event about racial equity and health outcomes. I wonder if you can just speak to that relationship for us now.
Thank you for that question. So as I mentioned earlier, and you know, the river metaphor and all that, the main contributors to health or illness are what we call social determinants, like housing, education, access to healthy food. And historically, racism has resulted in things like policies like redlining, for example, where black people weren't able to buy homes. It contributed to wealth disparity between black and white people. And that wealth is clearly tied to health. And actually, if you're in a neighborhood with schools that aren't as well-funded or as quality, education and educational attainment is associated with health outcomes. If you're in a neighborhood where you can't get healthy food, that also contributes to health outcomes. Those are the and if you have, you know, if the incarceration rate is higher for Black people than it is for white people, children with, you know, if they don't have one of their parents has gone from their home, that has a negative impact on that child, you know, that lasts with them for their lives. So these conditions and these policies that have existed and still, to some extent, still exist, have health impacts. Sure. And those are the kind of upstream things that we think need to be addressed.
So just briefly, because we are running short on time, public health is often invisible when it's working well. How do you make the case for investing in prevention when people tend to only notice crises?
By doing interviews like this and getting the information out. We do really try to get the information out. But, you know, also so communication and also getting people more involved civically so they so they can share what's going on and address some of these issues. And there's other organizations that we've already mentioned that are working, like Educational Opportunities for Children and Families is an organization, a local organization that works on early childhood education. If we could guarantee early child education for everybody, imagine how that would improve health outcomes down the road.
Right.
So there are other organizations that people can get involved in support as well. I'm not naming them all. I'm naming a couple of them here, but.
Thanks.
You know, one of the things, we just have just in a minute. Are Americans actually low on protein, Dr. Melnick? It seems to me that Americans eat an enormous amount of protein. Can you just give us one little comment?
The 15-second answer.
We hear this, right? We got 1 minute. But we hear like that we're low on protein. Are we low on protein?
I just heard something on the news today that said that they've changed the recommendations on that. But I don't know that there's any. We have a lot of challenges in terms of our diet in this country. But I think my concern is the lack of healthy food available for certain populations who live in what I would call a food desert, yeah, where you don't have healthy food options available. We need to really work on that. By the way, one other organization I want to mention, I'm sorry, is the YWCA that does really great work around domestic violence. And when you think about negative health outcomes for kids, it's being subjected to that. So, early childhood trauma is a significant problem. So I want to get that point in. But yeah, we need to make sure that everybody has access to healthy food.
Thank you.
Well, that's our show. As we said in the beginning, we are just in absolute awe of the number of duties that you have. Many thanks to you, Clark County Health Officer and Director, Dr. Alan Melnick. We've learned a great deal about public health. I'm Tracy Riley, and with Teresa Torres and Rachel Bancroft, this is Citizen 411. Citizen 411 is powered by the League of Women Voters of Clark County. It's produced at KXRW in Vancouver.